Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anant Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvisesa Sanyavadi Paskacha Deshatarani. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchaka Pachubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So it's April 19th, 2023 in Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 13, Further Talks Between King Rahugana and Judd Bharata, Text 10. Tarhi sma chikshu dra rasan vichinvams. Tan mastika bir vyavito vimana. Tatrati krishrat prati labdha mano.
Tatrati krishrat prati labdha mano.
Balad vilum pancha tatam tatonye. Karhi smachit. Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Kshudra.
Kshudra.
Very insignificant.
Very insignificant.
Rasan.
Rasan.
Sexual enjoyment.
Sexual enjoyment.
Vichinvan. Searching for.
Searching for.
Tut. Of those women.
Of those women.
Makshikabi.
By
honeybees or the husbands or family members. Vyatita.
Very much aggrieved.
Vimanaha. Insulted. Tatra. In that. Ati.
Ati.
Very much.
Very much.
Krichrat.
Krichrat.
With difficulty because of spending money.
With difficulty spending money.
Prati labdham anha.
Prati labdham anha.
Obtaining sexual enjoyment.
Obtaining sexual enjoyment.
Balat.
Balat.
By force.
By force.
Vilumpanti.
Kidnapped.
Ataha.
Thereafter.
Tam. The object of sense enjoyment, the woman.
The object of sense enjoyment, the woman.
Tataha. From him.
From him.
Anye.
Anye.
Another debauchee.
Another debauchee.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Sometimes, in order to have a little insignificant sex enjoyment, one searches after debauched women. In this attempt, one is insulted and chastised by the women's kinsmen. This is like going to take honey from a beehive and being attacked by the bees. Sometimes, after spending lots of money, one may acquire another woman for some extra sense enjoyment. Unfortunately, the object of sense enjoyment, the woman, is taken away or kidnapped by another debauchee. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In a great forest, honeycombs are very important. People often go there to collect honey from the combs, and sometimes the bees attack and punish them. In human society, those who are not Krishna conscious remain in the forest of material life simply for the honey of sex life. Such debauchees are not at all satisfied with one wife. They want many women. Day after day, with great difficulty, they try to secure such women, and sometimes while trying to taste this kind of honey, one is attacked by a woman's kinsman and chastised very heavily. By bribing others, one may secure another woman for enjoyment. Yet another debauchee may kidnap her or offer her something better. This woman hunting is going on in the forest of the material world, sometimes legally and sometimes illegally. Consequently, in this Krishna consciousness movement, the devotees are forbidden to have illicit sex. Thus they avoid so many difficulties. One should remain satisfied with one woman being duly married. One can satisfy one's lusty desires with his wife without creating disturbances in society and being punished for doing so. Karhi sma chit kshuda rasan vachin vams tan makshika bir vya tito vimanaha tatrati kritrat prati labdamano balad vilum panti atatam tato nye. Sometimes, in order to have a little insignificant sex enjoyment, one searches after debauched women. In this attempt, one is insulted and chastised by the woman's kinsmen. This is like going to take honey from a beehive and being attacked by the bees. Sometimes, after spending lots of money, one may acquire another woman for some extra sense enjoyment. Unfortunately, the object of sense enjoyment, the woman, is taken away or kidnapped by another debauchee. So everybody knows that illicit sex is bad. Everybody. This is not a secret. Everybody. You don't have to be a member of the Hare Krishna movement or even a religious person. Everyone can understand that promiscuity is harmful. That this is, again, it's well known among everybody. At the same time, at the modern time, promiscuous, casual sex is the norm in the media. So much so that, you know, people often assume that anybody from a Western country is, you know, basically a promiscuous, easy, sexually easy person because they see so much of that in the movies and television. And it's this sort of contradictory thing. It's just like I was reading an article the other day about how much casual alcohol drinking goes on in TVs and movies, and the fact that such is giving a bad impression to young people. I was thinking about how when I was young, you would see a lot of cigarette smoking in TVs and movies. You know, it was just casual. Everybody was smoking cigarettes. And after a while, the media producers decided to cut down on that, because they saw it was having a bad effect. But this is still going on with alcohol, and it's certainly going on with illicit sex, and just very casual illicit sex is just the norm. And of course, even though, again, everyone understands that this is bad, more and more the culture is becoming accepting of people having extremely casual, promiscuous relationships. And being very, to say it, in kind words, experimental, you know, experimenting with all different sorts of relationships. So this is the society that we're in, and to speak about the harms of illicit sex in 2023 in modern society is actually sort of politically risky. I mean, of course, the same was true when Prabhupada came to America in the 60s and 70s, that easy, relatively safe birth control had become widely available, and then abortion was made legal, which started, and then antibiotics for disease, which started the whole sexual revolution, you know, make love, not war kind of thing. And I remember a song that was popular when I was growing up, if you can't be with the one you love, just love the one you're with. And that was a lot of the mood in the 60s and 70s of the counterculture, what came to be called the hippies, was a rejection of the what they perceived as materialism of their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. And it was interesting, you know, instead of drinking alcohol, they were smoking marijuana and taking LSD, and instead of getting married and having kids and a dog and a house in the suburbs, they were having, you know, promiscuous, illicit relationships. They just went from Rajagun to Tamagun. So Prabhupada also had difficulty when he came preaching about these things. It wasn't popular. saying no intoxication, no illicit sex was certainly unpopular then. And it's also unpopular now. I mean, I've often said that preaching about Varna, preaching like we have this upcoming book and course on career dharma, is basically of interest to pretty much anyone. If you say to people, would you like to have a career that's the highest expression of your best nature and that brings you a life of meaningful prosperity and makes a difference in the world? So the vast majority of people will agree to that. The vast majority of people will say, yes, I really want that, which is, of course, Varna Dharma. But if you say to people, would you like to have a life where your sexual behavior and relationships are regulated according to your time of life, most people would not be particularly interested. And we have to say that even a lot of devotees wouldn't be interested. So this is, you know, Prabhupada saying we forbid illicit sex, but of course, in our Hare Krishna movement, we've also had a lot of illicit sex. We've had a lot of, you know, people having affairs, a lot of divorce and remarriage, and we've had a lot of, we have to say, even rape and child sexual abuse, and, you know, horrible, the worst kinds of illicit sex. So even that has gone on. Obviously, it's a problem. Obviously, it's something that's not it's not an insignificant problem. And of the four regulative principles, this one seems to be the most difficult. You don't find very many initiated devotees eating meat, fish, and eggs, and you don't find very many initiated devotees gambling. You'll find some struggling with intoxication. You find some who struggle with gambling. But a greater number that struggle with some form of intoxication. But with illicit sex, it's definitely more of a problem. So let's look at what is the problem and what is the draw of illicit sex. And then I want to look at the reality, the ultimate reality of God, and then how we're going to get cured of this. So the harms of illicit sex are, again, I think they're pretty obvious, but it's worth stating them. Well, one of them is disease. There are so many sexually transmitted diseases. Obviously, there's HIV, and there's syphilis, and gonorrhea, and there's a whole list of them. And many of them cause very severe, long-term, harmful effects on people. Some of these diseases, like HIV, is not really curable, and it's only manageable with horrible chemicals. You know, there's a lot of antibiotic-resistant syphilis and gonorrhea, which can cause all kinds of, you know, long-term health problems and even death and all sorts of deformity and death in any children born to people who are sick. And there's other sexually transmitted diseases that can cause cancer down the road, or, you know, a lot of them are incurable. Certain kinds of herpes or genital warts, and they're really incurable. They're somewhat manageable but incurable. And so, you know, you just have one foolish sexual encounter and you have a disease for the rest of your life. And, you know, this is not inconsequential, and modern medicine is not fully able to reverse these effects. Then, of course, there's unwanted children. So, you know, we've gone from 4% of children born out of wedlock in the 60s to 40% of children born out of wedlock. And there's ample sociological statistics that children will do better if they're born in marriage, you know, with their biological parents, raised in a loving family. There's just so much evidence. If we're going to talk about children's physical health, mental health, emotional health, likelihood of becoming a criminal, likelihood themselves of having unstable relationships, likelihood of drug abuse, on and on and on and on and on. The number one factor for whether or not someone is going to have good physical health, good mental health, good emotional health, stable relationships with other people, whether they're going to be a productive member of society, whether or not they're going to be a criminal, whether or not they're going to abuse substances, is whether or not a person was raised by mother and father who are married to each other and treat each other with respect. That is absolutely the number one thing. And we have to say that it's an increasing problem that this sort of scenario has become the exception. That I can no longer assume, if I'm talking to a room full of 50 people, that the majority of them were raised in such a situation. You know, it's just, it's no longer the norm. And this is true as much with our devotees as with anybody else. Our devotee community tends to mirror whatever general society it's placed in. You know, domestic violence, sexual abuse, child physical abuse, child neglect, child emotional abuse, families breaking up and remarrying and blended families, and you know, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And the cost is so high for all of society, you know, and people don't want to talk about this, but it's the reality. And all the sociologists and all the psychologists and the social workers and the teachers all know this, that the number one factor is our children raised in an intact, happy family. So having unwanted children just destroys society. It's the main functions of the grihastha ashram are to provide good population and honest wealth for the society, and having unwanted children is just catastrophic, and the results are generational. That children who have, you know, childhood trauma, they go on to struggle, many of them, to have stable families themselves. And it tends to be a generational trauma thing, and society becomes very disrupted. Also, illicit sex leads to a lot of violence and even murder. 55% of murders occur between intimate partners or those very closely connected with them. Like, it might, you know, so your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, or your intimate partner's parents or siblings or something like that, or some jealous other person. And, you know, just horrible. And a lot of this is from illicit sex. You know, somebody cheats on their boyfriend or cheats on their husband or cheats on their wife, etc. And the betrayed party kills them, or the sister kills them, or the father kills them or something. And this is, you know, whenever there's a murder, first person they look to is the spouse or the boyfriend, girlfriend. And after that, they look at the intimate family members, because that's likely to be the case. How horrific. And then just betrayal. Illicit sex involves a lot of betrayal. You know, sex means that you're giving someone else your body, your most valuable possession, your body. And generally it also means that you're giving them your emotions and your thoughts. And in many relationships, you're giving them, you know, the passwords to your bank account and the keys to your car and the keys to your front door. And then that person goes and cheats on you with somebody, and it's devastating. I mean, people that I know that have gone through this, being betrayed by a boyfriend, girlfriend, or husband and wife, I mean, it can take them sometimes years to recover from this betrayal and be able really to trust again. It's it's a very serious thing. And it damages people's emotions. It damages people's ability to have a stable, like Prabhupada says, marriage is to make the mind peaceful, so you can execute Krishna consciousness, but illicit sex makes the mind unpeaceful. And, you know, what to speak of the more horrific types of illicit sex, like here in the verse it's talking about forcing a woman, so, you know, rape, child sexual abuse. I mean, that kind of situation, and the effects, it's just these ripple effects of emotional harm. So it's not just the abused child, but it's the abused child's, you know, parents and siblings and grandparents and cousins and uncles and aunts, and the whole community is emotionally affected by the fact that, you know, some child was sexually abused or that some woman was raped, and the effects, the emotional effects, go on for sometimes years. You know, it can take years of therapy for somebody to become stable, and they may never become fully stable. And and again, it tends to be generational. It tends to go on, and it affects people's trust. It affects people's trust in themselves, trust in others. And these are not inconsequential results. You know, one person loses control over their genitals and their mind and commits some illicit act, and it affects, you know, dozens or sometimes hundreds or sometimes thousands of people are adversely affected by this one person's inability to, as we say, keep it in their pants. You know, it has these terrible, terrible ripple effects. And someone's, like saying here, shudra, very insignificant, you know, so the person is getting whatever, their 2 minutes, their 1 hour of some kind of sensory pleasure. You know, you think, like, if you eat too many pieces of cake, so you may feel bloated and you may gain weight and it may be uncomfortable for you, you know. But if you can't control your sex desire, and then you create problems, again, potentially for dozens or hundreds or thousands of people. And it's the harm is really inestimable. So why do people do it? I mean, you would think that with such severe consequences, personally and societally, that the number of people who would do this would be very small. So, of course, there's a draw of physical pleasure. Krishna says that he himself is sexual pleasure, which counteracts the difficulty of begetting. So we're dealing with a very, very powerful attractive force. And, of course, the sex drive is built in biologically, physically, and psychologically into us so that we will produce children. And so it is a strong biological urge. It's as much, especially in youth, a biological urge as wanting to eat and sleep and drink water. And then as far as illicit sex, there's the thrill of breaking a rule. There is some kind of thrill of doing something wrong and trying not to get caught. I mean, you see this in little children, where little children will do things that they know they're not supposed to do just for the thrill of doing something they know they're not supposed to do. You know, they'll go and turn over the garbage can or something. I mean, I remember clearly when I was 2 years old putting toys into the humidifier vent just to watch. I would keep putting toys in there and tissue paper and stuff until the water would stop coming out. And my father would very patiently explain to me that I was doing something wrong and show me how he was cleaning out the humidifier. And so I knew I was doing something wrong, but I would go do it again because it was so much fun to watch the water vapor go away. And there was some thrill of doing something that I wasn't supposed to do. So this thrill of I'm doing something wrong and getting away with it, I mean, maybe the root of that is that we want to think that we're not under the control of material nature, that we're not under the control of God, that we're independent beings. So there's definitely some of that. Also a sense of extreme attachment. You know, Srila Prabhupada writes that if someone is attached to, sexually attached to someone to whom they're not married, that attachment tends to be extremely strong. So some severe, very extreme attachment is often at work here. You know, and people will they'll psychologically convince themselves about how, you know, I'm not feeling any love for my wife anymore or my husband anymore, and I'm just bored, and this person is so exciting, and etc. Then the fact that Krishna says that material desire can't be satisfied by connecting with the sense objects, that lust is like a burning fire. And, you know, Prabhupada's writing here about be satisfied. He's writing from the man's position of being satisfied with one wife. But the problem is that no matter how much wonderful, wonderful sex a man may be having with one wife, maybe he's, you know, having a lot of quantity and quality with his one wife. The nature of material desire is that you want more. It's just the nature of the thing. And why is it the nature of the thing? Because contact with the material senses is innately insatisfying. It's not touching the soul. It's not satisfying us. And I've given this example so many times, but it's worth repeating how one time it was a fast day, so I was fasting from food and water, and I took a little rest during the day. And I was dreaming that I was at a huge feast. I remember there were pakoras, cauliflower pakoras, in my dream feast. And I was also very thirsty. So in my dream, I drank a cup of water, and then I was still thirsty. So I drank another cup of water, and I was drinking cup after cup after cup of water. And finally, I picked up in my dream a gallon jug of water, and I was chugging it and drinking it. And then at a certain point in my dream, I had this thought that what's going on? You know, I'm drinking so much water and I'm still thirsty. And then I woke up from the dream and I thought, oh, it was dream water. I wasn't drinking real water, and therefore my body, it was still thirsty. So all the sense objects in this world, whether it's sex, whether it's food, whatever it is, whether it's silk clothing, it's not touching the soul. It's only touching the body and the mind. We are the observer. It's very much, I've given this example so many times. I mean, Shastra gives the example of a dream. But, you know, of reading a book or watching a film or a movie, and the character in the book or the film gets the girl and gets money and kills all the bad guys. But you're just still, you know, some slump sitting in your chair, sitting on your couch, you know, needing to lose weight and eating potato chips and not having done anything significant in life. So the activities of the people in the book or the film, they don't really make you an accomplished person. You know, while you're reading the story or watching the story, you might identify with the hero and think, you know, you're turning off the bomb 1 minute before the world blows up or something. And actually you've never done anything more significant in your life. Other than to pay your bills and eat something. So it's not really satisfying. You know, once the movie's over, you realize that you're just as much of an ordinary, useless person as you were before the movie. Or playing computer games, you know, where people identify with some character in the game, and again, the character is killing the bad guys, and the character is getting the treasure and so many things. And you're not doing anything. It doesn't affect you. And so it's ultimately not satisfying. No matter how many computer games you play and how many movies you watch and how many books you read and how many dreams you have, it doesn't change your actual life. You know, the character in the movie gets $1 million and your bank account still has 100 in it. And so it's like that with material sense enjoyment. It's not touching the soul. It's not touching the soul. The soul is just watching. Just like we're watching a play. And there, because of identifying with the body and the mind, you know, it seems to us that it's our pleasure. It seems to us that the pleasure of the body and the mind are our pleasure. And, you know, for a few moments, we may think, yes, it's like, you know, you're reading or hearing the story or playing the game, and there might be a few moments you're like, yes! I have saved the world! I have a beautiful woman by my side! But very quickly, it dissipates. It's not genuine. And then the problem is that a conditioned soul then thinks, well, let me get that brief high again. That moment when I identified with the hero in the movie, let me get that again. So a person is thinking, you know, okay, I had sex and now it's over and my life is back to where it was. But maybe if I just do it again. And it gets boring and they think, well, maybe if I just had another partner, or a different gender of partner, or whatever, you know, a different color of partner, then then I would get to keep it. It would be mine, but it doesn't work. And we're pleasure seeking by nature. And so it's very understandable why a conditioned soul would keep on going and going and going. Right? And another reason is envy. You know, Ishopanishad says, Ishivasya Midam Sarvam, we should be satisfied with our quota. Each of us has a quota of everything. We have a quota of how much money we're going to get. We have a quota of, you know, how much health we're going to get. We have a quota also of how much sex enjoyment we're going to get in a lifetime. Some people are not going to get any for a variety of reasons. Some people are going to get a lot. Some people are going to get somewhere in the middle. And how much sex we get and how pleasurable that sex is a lot. It's our destiny. We have a particular quota. And a person is envious. How, you know, it seems that this other person has more enjoyment. Their spouse is more attractive. Their spouse is whatever. You know, or again, they're looking at some magazine or book or TV show and here's this person that has, you know, like James Bond, whatever beautiful woman he wants. And it's envy. Let me do that. How come James Bond gets to do that? Why don't I get to do that? Ultimately, you know, God gets to do that. Why don't I get to do that? I know one devotee that told me when he first read Krishna book, he was thinking, why does Krishna get all the gopis? So it's ultimately an envy. That I'm not satisfied with my own quota of whatever it is. You know, I want more, I want different. And especially illicit sex that involves taking someone else's spouse, someone else's girlfriend, it's certainly envy. You know, certainly, that is definitely envy. And it's very prominent. I remember I used to teach a logic class to my Gurukul high school students, and part of it was studying advertising. So we would get a whole bunch of regular magazines and cut out the advertisements and categorize them in which way were they manipulating and deceiving people. And I remember one advertisement, I think it was for cigarettes, where there's this man and woman on a motorcycle, the woman's on the back of the motorcycle. Then there's another man on another motorcycle. And the woman who's on the back of the one motorcycle with her boyfriend or husband or whatever in front of her, she's looking back and smiling at the guy on the other motorcycle because he's smoking this cigarette. And I thought, wow. You know, they're saying, smoke this kind of cigarette and you can steal your, you know, someone else's girlfriend or someone else's wife. And that it's, you know, a big accomplishment. I'm going to steal a woman away from her husband, steal her away from her boyfriend. So it's just shocked me that this was in an advertisement, you know, appealing to some aspect of psychology. There's some it's there in women too, you know, women who have affairs with married men. Now, there are lots of women who have affairs with married men and want the married men to leave their wife, leave their children, and run off with her. So both men and women do this, actually target somebody who's with somebody else, and when that person leaves their significant other for them, then they feel very accomplished. So all this stuff is happening. Why is it happening? Ultimately it's happening because Krishna does these things. Krishna has an unlimited number of wives and an unlimited number of girlfriends. Unlimited. Prabhupada writes that Krishna cannot be lusty, he said, but if you want to say he's lusty, then he's unlimitedly lusty. So Krishna's activities with his many, 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 many girlfriends and his many, 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 many wives, uncountable, is the reality of which our desire is a reflection. And we are part of him, and as part of him, it's natural that we also have this desire. We want pleasure, and we especially want pleasure by becoming one with and different from another living being, and that is certainly what sexual intercourse is all about. It's about where, like the Bible says, you become one flesh, but you're still two people, right? And this sort of becoming one and different is there in all of the rasas. When you're a parent, you feel that the child is part of your body, because they are, especially the mother feels like that. But yet you're two separate persons. In friendship, it's even like that. Even master and servant, there is some sense like that. That I'm one with this person, and yet we're distinct. This achinta beta beta tattva, but it's particularly strong in a sexual relationship. This oneness yet difference. And this is what we're looking for. There's a great draw, because that's what it's like with Krishna. But Krishna's relationship with his wives and his girlfriends, it's actual love and it's actual union. Rupa Goswami says the love, particularly of the gopis, generally of the queens, but always with the gopis, is called samartha, where your beloved's happiness and your happiness are the same. Where your happiness is that the beloved is happy. You don't feel a separate happiness. This is a oneness. And we all experience a little of that in this world. We certainly can experience some of that in sexual relationships, but also even in other relationships, in any of the rasas, that we can feel that, you know, if my child's happy, that's my happiness. If my friend's happy, that's my happiness. That I don't need to look for happiness separately from giving happiness to someone else. People feel that way about their pets even. So we have some idea of this, but spiritually it's absolute that Krishna's happiness is his devotee's happiness, and the devotee's happiness is his happiness, and the pinnacle of this is between Krishna and the gopis. An actual life increasing, you know, our sexual intercourse produces children and increases life in that way, but Krishna's union with his beloveds, it increases the feeling of aliveness. It increases life, and it's increasing life and love unlimitedly without end. And of course, because it's on the fully spiritual platform, it's real. You know, we get our material sense gratification. We get satiated, but we're not satisfied. And with Krishna's activities, there's full satisfaction, but no satiation. You can have more and more and more and more and more. It never becomes old. It's one of Krishna's qualities that he's ever fresh. You know, Radharani will see Krishna. She thinks she's seeing him for the first time. And he sees Radharani. He thinks he's seeing her for the first time. It is fascinating to me that Krishna has activities that are apparently illicit. I just find it completely fascinating. Even in the spiritual world, in the spiritual world, there's no law, there's no police, there's no consequences for immoral activities. We were naming in the beginning of this class all these horrendous consequences of immoral sexual life. But that isn't the case in the spiritual world. There's no law at all. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the only law in the spiritual world is have love and have no envy. Positive is love and negative is no envy. That's all. There's no other rule. So what rule is Krishna breaking? I mean, even in his pastimes in the material world, everybody belongs to him. Prabhupada makes that point that actually the gopis, they belong to Krishna. In one sense, they are him. He said it's like playing with your reflection in a mirror. So, I mean, Krishna is the lawmaker. He is the law. He is yajna personified. He is dharma personified. How can he break his own laws? It's nonsensical. It's like he's would be breaking himself. There's no meaning to it. Krishna can't do anything that's naughty or that's illicit or that's immoral, or he is morality and he's the giver. All the definitions of good and moral and proper and licit. Art dharman tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. So, I mean, again, it's a nonsensical thing. How can good itself do something not good? So why does Krishna arrange this? I mean, and we see this with, you know, not just with his unmarried girlfriends who are all ostensibly married to others, which is the worst kind of debauchery in this world. If a man, an unmarried man, has a sexual relationship with a wife of someone else, that is definitely considered the worst. So why is he doing this? You know, and like I was saying, in this world we have some pleasure in doing things that are naughty and getting away with it. We do. It's definitely one of our enjoyments. There's no question about it at all. Like you think about, you know, the children who are sneaking candy with the parents don't see. Do you know parents sneak candy when their children aren't looking? The parents will go and sneak candy and ice cream when the children are asleep or the children are in another room. I mean, this tendency, what do they call it? Guilty pleasures. Obviously, it comes from Krishna. This sense of I'm breaking a rule. It also adds, of course, drama to the whole thing. You know, that doing something where there's some conflict, where the in-laws don't want you, you know, you've got conflict from the mother-in-law and the father-in-law and the sister and brother-in-law and the husbands. And so, you know, in this verse, it's talking about that those are like the bees. You're stealing the honey from the bees, and the bees are stinging you. But in Krishna's Leela, although apparently it's also like that, you know, Jitila is locking up Radharani in the house and stuff. It's all just sweet, because everyone involved is actually in love with Krishna. The so-called antagonists, the so-called husbands and mothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, they're all actually in love with Krishna. And it's all play, it's all a drama, it's all a game. But without any kind of conflict, there's no story, there's no fun. So Krishna also likes to set up this kind of conflict. So what is the cure for our problem with sex, particularly illicit sex? I mean, Prabhupada talks about in the purport, get married, satisfy your lusty desires with your spouse and be happy. That works for a lot of people, but obviously it doesn't work for everybody. If it worked for everybody, we wouldn't be having this problem in society. People would get married, be satisfied with their spouse, and that would be the end of that. And I don't think that's ever worked for everybody in society. I mean, there's always been prostitutes and illicit affairs. So, you know, having a dharmic life and getting married and being faithful to your spouse, very good idea. But that's not the whole thing, obviously. One has to be ultimately absorbed in Krishna's pastimes. And absorbed in Krishna's pastimes, so we are experiencing the ultimate spiritual pleasure, param drisva nivartite. We are pleasure-seeking. And if we just try to stop it, we won't be able to. It's our nature. It's who we are. Krishna's pleasure-seeking, we're pleasure-seeking. If we're not finding genuine spiritual pleasure, we will look for false pleasure. We cannot live without pleasure. Now, some people will go for, like, rasas of anger and fear and disgust. So we see people, devotees, that the way they deal with their sexual desire is they substitute the rasa of disgust. And they're always talking about how disgusted they are with sex. And I mean, you can be disgusted with the whole body. I don't know. I think using the toilet is a lot more disgusting than sex. So, you know, I mean, the whole world is disgusting in one sense. But that's not the cure, you know. Then you're just substituting one material attachment for another. There's 12 rasas. So instead of being in the romantic rasa, if you're in the disgust rasa, I don't think that's going to help you, materially speaking. So we want to be absorbed in the real. And also, of course, we do want to practice satisfaction with our own quota. So satisfaction with our own spouse, and if we don't have a spouse, then satisfaction with celibacy. There's so much benefit from celibacy that one can appreciate. There is so much freedom in life from being celibate, and not, especially if you have nothing to do with a romantic partner, and you don't have to put up with the particular ego trips of the opposite gender. You know, it just, it's great freedom. It's great. Vairagya is one of the six opulences. And one can learn to relish that vairagya. It can be a very sweet and wonderful thing. So to relish if you have a good, faithful partner, or to relish if you have, renunciation and austerity, to be satisfied with our own quota, to be grateful for our own quota, to be grateful for what Krishna's given me, and to be grateful for what Krishna's not given me. You know, I know one sannyasi who never married, and people ask him, and he said, I've saved myself the trouble. So to be grateful with what he's given and grateful for what he's not given. There is a positive and negative side to everything. So there's a very positive side to not being entangled in this whole sexual business. And there's a positive side to having a loving, faithful spouse. So whatever we have, appreciate that. Don't dwell on the negatives of it. The person who's married with a loving, faithful spouse, be appreciative of their positives and not the negatives of married life. And one who's in a situation of renunciation, whether by absolute choice or by force of circumstances, to focus on the positive sides of that and not the negative sides of that. And then, as we talk about a lot, to stop at the contemplation stage, that as long as we have a material body and mind, sexual thoughts are likely to enter our body and mind. To think that they never will is rather foolish and not shastrically sound. And it's, getting old doesn't cure the whole thing. Prabhupada always tells that story of the dying man who looked at the king's beautiful young girl. So it's not that just getting old solves the whole problem, or the being ugly or whatever. Getting disabled. Sometimes devotees think, well, if there's catastrophes in the world, then people will take up more Krishna consciousness. I always think that's a rather sad way of looking at things. But anyway, of course, the desires in old age are not generally as strong as the desires when you're 20. But the point is to stop things at the contemplation stage. That as soon as some thought comes in, just recognize it. Oh, so here's some sexual thought, whether it's a thought, physical sexual or emotional sexual, whatever. And just recognize it. No, okay, I have a material body in mind. The thought may come, and let it come and let it go. Don't grab it and don't try to kill it. Just let it go and it will pass. And as one practices that, then it's hardly even noticeable. It almost becomes automatic. And we can certainly do this, just like we go shopping for groceries and there's so many meat, fish, and eggs, and maybe before taking up Krishna consciousness we ate those things. But as you practice stopping at the contemplation stage, it becomes practically just automatic that you can walk by these things and they have no draw anymore. They're not attractive. What it means is that what we're doing that may have become practically automatic is that we're stopping it right at the beginning of the contemplation stage. So it's the same can be done with sexual attraction. That as soon as there's the slightest, tiniest whiff of contemplation, we recognize it and let it go. Again, it's not repressing it. Repressing it is a really bad idea and does not work. Repressed lust turns into anger. Or it explodes as some illicit thing. So that's also part of our sadhana, is to practice being free from attachment and aversion, to let desires flow like rivers into the ocean. That these desires will come. They'll come if you're married, they'll come if you're not married, they'll come if you're a brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, they'll come if you're a man or you're a woman, you're old or you're young, you're ugly, you're beautiful, whatever, some thought will come. Even if it's just emotional, oh, I wish I had somebody to talk to, cry to, hold their hand in the moonlight or whatever. And again, as we practice letting go at the contemplation stage, then it leaves us alone more and more often. But just doing that, avoiding attachment and aversion, and just being satisfied with our own quota is ultimately not enough. The jnanis do that, the yogis do that, and they tend to fall down. We have to be absorbed in the real. And we can say, well, so many people in Krishna consciousness also fall down. But then are they really in Krishna consciousness? We have to be absorbed in the real. Of course, Krishna and Guru excuse minor, short-term, unplanned mistakes. But still, as bhakti yogis, we should be absorbed in the real. We should be absorbed in the real. And then the illusion is not attractive when you're absorbed in the real. If you have your own adventures, you don't have to get on the computer and pretend to have adventures. You know, you don't have to. You have your own real adventures in life. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
What are your thoughts on the last part of Prabhupada's purport? In this Krishna consciousness movement, the devotees are forbidden to have illicit sex. Thus, they avoid so many difficulties. One should remain satisfied with one woman being duly married. One can satisfy one's lustful desires with his wife without creating disturbance in society and being punished for doing so.
I was hoping that nobody would ask me about that.
You were hoping or you were wondering?
I was hoping.
Okay. Yeah, how do we apply that to the application?
I am going to refuse to answer that question in a recorded class. I am going to let the purport be as it is. You can read it, you can understand it as you like, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
Sorry?
Okay, if you said.
Yeah.
I was thinking. I hope nobody brings this up, and that's it.
Turn off.
Sorry.
What if Ramananda turns the recording off?
Nope.
You want to answer?
Nope.
Nope. Okay.
Anybody could be sitting there recording.
Yes, I am recording.
Nope. Absolutely not. You can read the purport, you can read the words, you can understand what the words are, and you can draw your own conclusions, and beginning, middle, end, that's it.
I want to take the opportunity to thank Ramila and Mataji very much for giving us her association. She just notified us that she's only going to give another 3 classes. And then after that, do some extensive traveling, so we won't have instructions or classes very much longer. And, a lot of times we have the tendency to take things for granted, so I just staying only a few more classes to go, and then that's it. So I wanted to really, really thank Ramila Mataji for giving us so much of her association. It's really valued.
Well, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's always nice to talk about Prabhupada's books.
How much of an extended break is it going to be?
Long,
not forever, I hope.
Well, forever, that's up to God. If he wants to capture me and pull me out of this body while I'm gone, he can do that if he wants. Probably till somewhere around the end of the year.
Oh, that's not too bad. You just really give fantastic classes, Mataji. You really do.
Oh, thank you. Well, Srila Prabhupada's very kind to me. Whatever good you find for me is all His grace.
At the end of your classes, you always say additions, subtractions, and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so I want to lodge a complaint while I've still got a chance.
All righty.
Yes, I was actually quite disappointed when I asked you once if you would be willing to give a seminar, just some sort of a special class that would address how to have a difference of opinion with others to do it in such a way that it's respectful, how to debate respectfully.
Well, we actually have a class like that as part of hermeneutics. It's class 3 of hermeneutics. And if you go on YouTube, there is a hermeneutics channel, and all 8 classes should be up there. The 3rd class is taught by Hari Parshad Prabhu, and I would direct you to that. but that is class 3 of our 8-part hermeneutics classes.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, we do teach that, and any center who wants to arrange to teach the full 8 lessons, which we teach with various members of the Shastric Advisory Council, this wouldn't be a good platform for it, start meeting, because we need to share our screen and so forth. So we do that. We've had several places hosted, and that can certainly be arranged again. But that is, although that's the essence of Lesson 3, I'd say the whole hermeneutics course is focusing on this kind of a question. How do we understand difficult statements from Shastra, from Prabhupada, from our Acharyas? How do we have, you know, many different angles of vision? How do we have respect for these different angles of vision? I mean, many times I think people come into the hermeneutics class with the idea that the Shastric Advisory Council is going to give them the answer, just like with the last sentence of today's purport. You know, what is the answer? And I will tell you, there's probably at least 20 ways of understanding that last sentence. So it's, we go into we go into the traditional ways, the traditional Vedic and Vaishnav ways of how statements from Shastra and Guru and Acharyas are explained and understood and applied. And we have a series of qualities, principles, and tools that we use. We have extensive material on it. And pretty much everybody who's come through the course has said that it was really life-changing. We're convinced that if this course could be taught extensively throughout ISKCON, the whole culture of ISKCON would change. But it's very much in how to have a unity and diversity.
I'm sorry, but I'm actually having a hard time finding it. I put in hermeneutics, but what else has to be in the search?
Let me see if I can just find it for you and give you a link. It's a very interactive course, so just watching the videos will give you 1/10 of the benefit, but it should give you some good idea. And there should be links there to where you can download the materials. So what you could do is you could download the materials and then go through the materials while you're watching the videos. And if you were to do that with 2 or 3 other devotees, then you would get pretty close to the full, and you'd probably get like 80%.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. Anybody else have any question or comment on today's class?
Yes, I do. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Mahalakshmi.
Please accept my obeisances.
Please accept my
obeisances. I would like to know how to bring in harmony our understanding on how to please Krishna with what is going to really please Krishna.
What?
How to bring in harmony our understanding from due to conditioning, one may think that my behavior is going to please Krishna, but it might not be so. So how we come to the point of thinking, synchronizing with to please Krishna? I don't
understand what you're asking. How can we synchronize pleasing Krishna with pleasing Krishna?
Yes, due to conditioning, sometimes one may, or may not even consider, but one may think that I'm doing well, everything's going right, but it's not. It's much under the influence of misunderstanding.
Well, that's why we have Guru Sadhu Shastra. And then we want to make sure that we're open to being corrected by Guru Sadhu Shastra. I should be open when I'm reading the Shastra. I shouldn't be reading the Shastra just to find quotes that I can defeat other people with or prove that I'm already right. I should be reading the Shastra to be corrected. I like what Vaisheshika Prabhu says, I live to be corrected. And we should be associating with other devotees and with Guru so that we can be put back on the right path when we're off. We should assume that we're going to keep getting off the path and that we need to be corrected constantly. like you drive down the road, you know, you don't just hold the steering wheel straight, you have to move the steering wheel with the curves of the road. You're constantly, when you're driving a car, you're constantly doing a course correction, correct?
Yes.
Constantly. Constantly. You're not going to go on a road that's absolutely straight. So we have to always be course correcting, and that's from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Thankfully, Krishna is most interested in our intention to please him. That's what's most interesting to him. Not so much exactly do we get all the details and the results perfectly right. Now, obviously, if we're trying to please him, we'll try to get all the details and the rules perfectly right. We'll do our best to do that. But he's looking much more at our intention than exactly what our results are. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because we're never going to get everything right externally. Every endeavor is covered by some fault, like smoke covers fire. It's impossible for us to get all of the externals right all the time. We just won't. But we can get our intentions right. And then we do our best with the externals. You know, we do our best. It's not that we just say, well, I have good intentions. I'm just going to, you know, be a lazy person with the externals. Is that all right?
Thank you very much.
All right, I need to get going. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.